hello. Glad you're listening. Glad to be here. Welcome to American Hit Radio.
Yet another edition.
That's right. Coming to you from the always fantastic WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, Heidi Morales Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host as well.
You forgot who I was for a second there.
Just couldn't say your name properly. Didn't roll off of the tongue for some reason.
It didn't sound dignified, did it?
It's tough to say Morales Ryan for me.
I know. You'd like it if I just became you.
No, it's all right. I've like you said, I've got to take seriously this maybe the John Lennon thing and change my middle name to Morales for you.
I agree. I think so.
Tom and Heidi Morales Ryan. That would work. I could do that.
Okay.
Anyway, we're here to bring you another hour of American Hit Radio today. Well, we patiently, impatiently really are waiting for this winter to end. It's driving me crazy.
Melt snow.
Really? Last week, Heidi, if you recall, we were looking at some singles, hit singles from 1973. It was a lot of fun because we got to play some great songs. We all played a whole bunch of, you know, junk, too.
Right.
Stuff that we considered to be, you know, bad hits.
Yeah, well, that gives you perspective.
But it was fun. It was a good time. And what I wanted to do right now is cover albums that were out at that exact same time. If you could, like, recall last week's show and the singles that we were playing, I was talking about the difference between singles and albums, especially in 1973, because there was a significant difference in what was happening on the charts already in those two different categories. And I figure we'll dedicate this show exclusively to three albums that came out in February of 1973. These are all 40 years old now, which is pretty incredible to me. The thing that I guess I want to, you know, basically, rather than I obsess about the time that has passed, though, I mean, what I'm thinking more about is like how you more or less know an album is classic if you tend to associate it with a specific time and place. Like maybe you remember the first time that you heard it, or you associated with a road trip that you took and you played it often and you're like, oh,
right.
You know, boy, some of these records are like that for me. I can remember, like, really where I was at when I was, like, listening to them with some regularity. The fact is, to be honest, I didn't know any of these three albums when they came out in 1973. I discovered all of them a couple of years later, at least a couple of years later. So I think it was mostly because, well, for, you know, 1973, I'm still fairly young. I can't afford to buy as many records as I would like to. You know, at $6 a pop, it wasn't.
Yeah,
that
your
easy.
Allowance doesn't go that far.
Right. Yeah, I'm still a kid. I was, you know, barely in high school at this point in time. And so you've got that issue. And the radio was not really playing as much music as they once had been. There was still some progressive stuff, but you wouldn't get to hear a lot of this stuff often. So you'd have to do a lot of experimentation or reading about music history. And eventually, you know, some of the stuff I would find out about maybe two. I remember the Littlefeet album. I heard that for the first time when I was in a junior, and I was 1975. Some of this other stuff I didn't hear until 1977.
Yeah.
And I can remember, like I said, specifically where I was and how it affected me. And then I began to think, like, boy, I'm missing a lot of good music. There's a lot of stuff that's going on that I've got to catch up on. I'm sure it's happening to this very day. Really, the reason I'm doing this show now for people is maybe for some it's to hear stuff that they already know. But I'm also hoping that what I'm doing is I'm helping some other people catch up with some older stuff that they might have missed. One band that I had given up on by 1973 was the Beach Boys. Brian had completely lost his muse after the Smile sessions. It's almost like he ceased to write, or, you know, he really wasn't writing at all with the same flair that his previous stuff had.
Right.
And I just lost complete interest in the band. They didn't even seem cool by like 1968. They seemed anything but. While everybody else was, you know, basically going off in the hippie direction, and there was like, you know, you think about things like, say, Jimi Hendrix or Buffalo Springfield, some of the, you know, even the Beatles, of course, where they were at by 1968 and 69. And then you think of the Beach Boys in those Pendleton shirts and stuff. You're like, oh, the image was just totally, you know, it was almost ludicrous.
It was so square comparatively.
Yeah,
at that point.
They fell off my radar for about a good 5 years. But it was in 1973 when I did hear some stuff on the radio that made me realize, wow, Brian really can still write. There still is some good stuff. It was sort of a comeback album of sorts. It was called Holland. And they had been through a few different things in the meantime. They actually temporarily, or I guess as a bit of like a just a change in scenery or, you know, basically presentation, they changed their name for one record even to Carl and the Passions. You know, and that was basically, I think, mostly because Brian's writing had become so irrelevant to what was happening. And Carl was becoming the predominant songwriter and singer in the band. So they put out an album and they entitled it Carl and the Passions. And it did okay. It wasn't a great record. It certainly didn't attract me back to the band at that point. I only know it now in retrospect, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the album, this was the follow-up to that album. And they were back to being the Beach Boys. And this was them really trying to make a push to become popular again, to try to get back onto the top 40, which they had actually fallen off of that. They were having a hard time even having a hit at this point in time. And it was successful in that regard. I mean, it certainly wasn't Good Vibrations. You know, those days were essentially gone. But it was nice to hear that there was stuff that the band could do that was still musically relevant, and they sounded hip. In fact, the song sounded kind of cool. And, you know, the good thing about a great Beach Boys track is that when you heard it, it could give you the chills. And that was what was happening when I heard this song from the album Holland. Here it is, one of Brian's tunes, showing that he still had it. This is called Sail On Sailor.
is an eyeglass of heroes, bridged with bright replies. The creek is a funnel of forgiveness, winning every prize. The steamboat of the river's a dreaming of waltz time. Banks of jasper glazed, ever ball and sing. The stream is a timepiece of children, bridged with crystal haze.
They're two of my favorite tracks off of the album Holland by the Beach Boys. It was a very spotty album, to be honest. I mean, not all the stuff on the record was great by any means. Yeah, there was Mike Love was going through this whole he was finally.
The good thing is via iTunes, you can probably just buy those two songs. If that's
yeah, there's a couple. I'd like to play one more because there's another one that I really like on the album as well. Carl, as I said, he was really becoming like the primary writer for the band, kind of like, you know, picking up the slack that Brian had left. And he wrote a really good song on this record, too. So let's play what I think is like Carl's best song on this album. This is this song is called The Traitor, also from the album Holland.
Hi.
Traitor sailed a jeweled crown.
Tracks from a sleeper album, really, by the Beach Boys. If you want to get that album now, by the way, what they've done is they've reissued the Beach Boys catalog as twofers, where you actually get two albums on one CD, so it helps a little bit. You know, this album and the Carl and the Passions So Tough record that I said that came out back to back are now packaged together as one disc.
Interesting.
So you get them, you know, it's a little bit more bang for your buck if you're interested. Anyway, that was the first album I wanted to play. The next album is one of the most influential albums on my life. It's by Little Feat. It wasn't the first Little Feat album that I had heard, to be honest. The first Little Feat album that I had purchased was called The Last Record Album. It was their fifth album. So I was very late to the party, so to speak.
Tardy to the party.
1975 is when I got turned on to the band. Now, this album, I said, was already 2 years old. And when I went back and discovered the band and their history, and they quickly became, for about a good 15 or 20 years, Little Feat was my favorite band in the world.
Mm-hmm.
No band influenced me more than Little Feat, especially in regards to my style of playing, my taste, and the things that it led me to. Going back in history to this album, the album Dixie Chicken is what came out in February 1973. And it was the first album where the band changed their personnel a lot. They were originally a four-piece band, very strange, esoteric band on their first two albums. Great stuff, but they were a weird band. This album, they suddenly became like a much funkier band. They lost one bass player. They brought in a bass player and a conga player to take his place. And then they also brought in Paul Barrere as a second guitar player. So now they've got all these extra members. And it was still a matter of space. They didn't sound like they were filled up and chock full of stuff. Everybody was just as thoughtful about what they didn't play as about what they did play. So there was a lot of room. And the songs took a lot of time for them to sink in because they were not, they didn't really grab you at first. And the cool thing was, I didn't realize it at the time, But this was really me getting introduced to contemporary New Orleans-style music. Well, George had developed a huge obsession with the city of New Orleans and its music. And this was the album where he pretty much started writing everything, trying to utilize the feel of those rhythm sections, trying to get that really great, like a second line groove where things would basically be having some sort of like a real heavy rhythmic feel without it being too blatant, different than like a straight ahead rock and roll thing that everybody else was doing. So this was an amazingly cool album for its time. To think that this was out in 1973 impresses the heck out of me. And like I said, I probably didn't hear this record until late 1975 when I started to go back through the band's catalog after picking up last record album. But it soon became one of my, like every Little Feat album at one point in time was my favorite record album one time or another. Those first five albums, all of them genius. This is the one, I guess, that people go to the most. So let's play a track written by Lowell George from that. I'm going to avoid the title track because everybody knows the title track. I don't have to play Dixie Chicken. I don't think we need to do that. We'll go a little bit deeper. The second track on the album written by Lowell George that really conveys that New Orleans feel, I think. This is called Two Trains.
I found my love. In 1967, I had all there was. And as my time went by, I was satisfied. Till that situation took me by surprise. Eloquent profanity
rolls right off my tongue. And I have dined in palaces, drunk wine with kings and queens. But darling, oh darling, you're the best thing I ever seen. Won't you roll me easy? Oh, slow and easy. Take my independence with no apprehension, no tension. You're walking, talking, paradise, sweet paradise. I've been across this country from Denver to the ocean, and I never met girls that could sing so sweet like the angels who live in Houston, singing, roll me easy, so slow and easy. Play the concertina, be your temptress, and baby, I'm defenseless, singing harmony in unison, sweet harmony. Gotta hoist your flag and I'll beat your drum.
I just love this stuff so much. I still love it. I mean, I hear this. It's as fresh to me. I must have heard that song in my lifetime 20,000 times.
One of the rare luxuries you afford yourself.
One of the things I actually do listen to over and over again. It's true. Yeah,
right.
Once I fell in love with Little Feat, I really never, ever fell out of love with the band. And those first five albums are just unbelievably great. And they're all so different from one another. They really are. The band changes drastically from one record to the next, and yet they stay really interesting. And like I say, this is the album that I associate as being their New Orleans album. You heard a little bit of that on the track Two Trains. You're going to hear a lot of it on this next song. They literally, at the time, I had no idea who Alan Toussaint was. 1973, then, of course, responsible for so many hits that came out of the city by 1973. He was huge. And he was but as far as a solo artist, he was virtually unknown really outside of New Orleans.
Right.
But he was making his own records at around that time, and Lowell George had heard them and decided to cover one of his songs on this album. And it was, you know, my first reaction is, you know, who's the guy that wrote this song? Who's this guy Toussaint or whatever? You know,
right.
Who is that? So, of course, you know, this is the great thing about, you know, great albums. They send you on this mission to find out other things. And eventually I found myself obviously falling in love with New Orleans music, falling in love with, you know, the city of New Orleans, falling in love with my wife who came from New Orleans. You know, everything more or less happens for a reason, you figure. And it's really funny if you really trace back. I said, boy, I bet you if I'd never bought the album Dixie Chicken, I might not have ever had that, you know, passion to want to go to New Orleans in the first place.
Interesting.
Makes you wonder. Well, here is that track written by Alan Toussaint from the same album. This is called On Your Way Down.
See very clearly when you're in flight.
Classic song, classic album. Like I said, one of the most influential albums of my life. The thing about Little Feat and on this album,
I can see where it would make you fall in love with wanting to find out about Alan Toussaint.
Yeah, right?
For sure.
That's such a slow, powerful groove on that song, you know? And it's not in what they're playing, although what they're playing is brilliant. It's really what they're not playing. It's all about the space.
That's right.
On that song. And I learned so much that I needed to know because, like every, you know, teenage drummer, you think it's all about the stuff that you can do.
Drum and, solos.
You know, really. Well, if not solos, at least, you know, how fast you can go, or the crazy syncopations that
crazy
you figured
patterns.
Out. And right, and these nutty things that you can do. And then this band comes out, and you're falling in love with it, and you realize that, wow, I have to really work twice as hard to not play that way. It's hard to stop yourself from overplaying, you know, when that's what you're used to doing. And this was a lesson that was a little late in coming for me. I wish I'd learned it at a younger age, but at least it happened. You know, it began to sink in that that's what I needed to do. And even, you know, it wasn't like I learned it and did it overnight. I was probably overplaying for about, you know, even after this. But it was, I keep going back to it, to realizing it's in the space. Learn those patterns. And defy anybody as a, you know, musician to try to play that song and not play more than what that drummer plays. It's very hard to do. It really is.
You get a little excited.
Play one more track from this album, because this is probably one of the most classic songs ever released by the band, other than the title track, Dixie Chicken. And it's such a fun song. It's just got so much cool stuff going on in this song. Well, one of Lowell George's best tunes. A great version of it came out on the live album, Waiting for Columbus. I still have a bit of a soft spot in my heart, though, for the original album version from Dixie Chicken. This is called Fat Man in the Bathtub.
Start to
Wow. I mean, I just can't say enough about this stuff. I just, you know, I, how much this stuff has influenced me is maybe not the point. I guess what I'd really just like to do is just, I guess, you know, try to express my enthusiasm for it by making it that influential for other people. Because if more bands, if more players these days were influenced by bands like Little Feat, the music industry would be in a much better place than it is right now. If you think about Saigon,
that's not opinion, that's fact.
It really is fact. You know, think about it. I mean, think about where music ended up by from 1973, even just 10 years later in 1983, when everything's drenched in reverb and you have gated drums and synthesizers were taking over, and then you don't even have real players on records anymore. Everything is based upon digital, you know, digitized drums, and it just got away from us. And this was at a time when this band was really just, you know, fantastic players knowing how to listen to one another and give each other space. It was a heck of a, you know, lesson for me to learn, and great stuff, those first five Little Feat albums. All right, I got a bit of time left to play one more, and it's going to basically take us to the album GP, for the initials of the person who put it out, Gram Parsons, considered, I guess, these days as what, the father of country rock.
Okay.
It's a bit of a hard thing to really lay on one person, because if you know the Byrds were doing something that resembled country rock,
right,
pretty early, and
sure,
there was a lot of examples of things where, I mean, even Mike Nesmith in, you know, the Monkees
also
was doing,
yes,
a lot of, you know, country rock stuff.
Very true.
But so there was a lot of stuff out there that could have fallen into that category. But Gram Parsons was really the one who was trying to really get back to Nashville and challenge Nashville to accept him with his long hair and try to be like almost like a traditional sort of a country rock, a country guy with a rock and roll influence. This was his first solo album. Before this, he was in the International Submarine Band. He was in the Byrds for a while, probably why I guess he does get, you know, I mean, by being in the Byrds when they, you know, were in their country rock phase,
right,
this is really
did,
where it goes
what,
back
Sweethearts
to.
Sweethearts at the Rodeo.
Exactly. He was in the band then. The Flying Burrito Brothers is another, you know, one of those early breakout bands that were doing this sort of music. But every time he got in any of these bands, he ended up sort of taking over. So it got to the point where it just made sense that he would end up becoming a solo artist. And unfortunately, he didn't live long enough for his career to really blossom as much as it could have. But when the one thing about the first album that he put out, GP, this album, not only the fact that it's got some great songs on it, but he discovered this background singer to help join him, to, you know, basically help fatten out his sound.
Uh-huh.
And turned out to be Emmy Lou Harris. And she was like, obviously, maybe perhaps like the single most talented female singer in maybe the past 40 years that came from the country scene.
Phenomenal. So
this is like her debut performances on this record. The first time you ever really, you know, we ever heard Emmy Lou Harris as a human being singing on a record. It's, you know, she wasn't even a professional. Apparently it was a friend who had turned Gram Parsons onto her. He was just touring around and came, you know, said, you got to hear this girl sing. They went over to her house and they just started to like play some songs on guitar, and she would join in with them in their kitchen. And they were like, oh my God, listen to this. So it was just a matter of time before they brought her in and started using her in the band. But you'll hear her just, you know, interspersed throughout these tracks from the album GP. Here then is one of those songs. This is called Still Feeling Blue.
Time can pass and time can heal, but it don't ever pass the way I feel. You went away a long time ago, and why you left I never knew. The lonely days and lonely nights, I guess the world knows I ain't feeling right. And when you're gone the hours pass so slow, and now I'm still feeling blue. Yeah. And baby, since you walked out of my life, I've never felt so low. Can't help but wonder why way. And ever since the day you said goodbye,
baby. Since you walked out of my life, I've never felt so low. Can't help but wonder why you had to go. There are many girls, but I can't say. They come and go, but still I feel this way. And ever since the day you said goodbye, no one treats me like you used to do. I hope you're out and happy now, doing up the town, 'cause you know how. Every time I hear your name, I wanna die. I loved you every day, and now I'm leaving. And I can see the sorrow in your eyes. I hope you know a lot more than you're believing. Just so the sun don't hurt you when you cry.
tomorrow we may still be there. And tomorrow we may still be there.
An album that's just full with really, you know, beautiful songs. And you can see it's a really deeply country record. It's not one of those things that flirts with country as a style. It really is coming from a place of country music, but trying to present it as something with a bit of a rock and roll feel. A lot of the players on this album were coming right out of Elvis Presley's band.
You got, really?
You know, James Burton is the guitar player on most of the record. Ronnie Tutt is the drummer. So, you know, you got guys like, you know, Sneaky Pete, of course, on pedal steel, I guess, and Byron Berline on fiddle, Glenn D. Harden on piano. These are all names of, like, people that have gone on now to basically be legendary in terms of being...
like Hall of Famers.
Yeah, yeah, right. You know, these people that were part of the real country scene that weren't afraid to play with the Rock and Rollers, which actually lent them a certain, you know, cachet of coolness, you know, a little later on. I wish I had time to play more from all of these records, because I just love them all so much. There's other albums from February 1973 as well that I'd like to cover. Maybe we'll be able to do this again next week. A few more albums from this era.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Why not? Now, on those tracks we played, you heard Emmy Lou as a background singer, lending her gorgeous harmony, trying to, almost like she's supporting Graham, because his voice can get a little shaky here and there.
She,
you know,
always has that knack of just finding where she fits in perfectly, and it's like a natural God-given gift that she has.
No doubt. She sings a harmony part almost as though that's the way the part should be in the first place. I think that if she was going to approach any song, she tends to sing the harmony rather than the main line. Even when she does her own material, it seems to come out like that. It's a stunning gift. It really is. And she's better at it than almost anybody. You're going to hear a little bit better on this track. I think she actually swaps verses with Graham on this song, and this is how we'll leave you then. From the album GP, this song is called That's All It Took, and That's All We Got. So I hope you can join us next week, and tune in on Friday at 5, too, because we're going to be back with ending up our coverage of the Beatles. See y'all then. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
That's all it took, the mention of your flame. I've tried so hard to let you go, but look, I still tremble at your name. That's all it took. That's all it took to make me know. I'm happy, but they really